This episode of the Hollyfield Nutrition Podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. To save 10% off of your first month of therapy, check out the link in the show notes, which is betterhelp.com/hollyfueled. That's BetterHelp, better, HELP.com/hollyfueled. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Hollyfield Nutrition Podcast. I am your host. I am Holly Samuel. I am a board-certified sports dietitian and a certified personal trainer with my master's in health education, focusing in eating disorders. And on the podcast today, we're going to dive into intermittent fasting and just fasting in general as it pertains to performance. I did an episode on this a while ago, I think the first year I had the podcast and my business. So if you were listening back then and remember that one and you're still here, hi, I love you so much. Thank you for being here 4 years later. And if you're new, hi, I love you too. Thank you for being here now. And I was excited to kind of dig this one back up and revamp it and basically redo the episode and add a little bit more updated research, some updated opinions that I have on fasting, because fasting really hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't gone away. If anything, it's just gotten more popular. It's gotten rebranded a bunch of times. And I do think it's here to stay for the most part, because not eating is convenient for people and gets exacerbated by diet culture. I definitely don't think fasting's like all bad. But I do think that there's definitely pros and cons, and there's populations it works okay for and populations it really doesn't work okay for. So we're going to dive into the research, what that says. Spoiler alert, there's like a lot of research lacking in terms of like performance outcomes, but from what we do have, I'm going to dive into that for you guys, because I know I get asked about this topic all the time. And like I said, I don't think fasting is going anywhere. I think it's here to stay. So I wanted to dig back up this episode, revamp it, and put it back out there. So without further ado, let's dive in. All right. So first, let's kind of get into what is intermittent fasting. Like, let's define it, because there's a lot of different methods of fasting. And that's part of the issue we have with the body of research, is that there's not like an abundance of studies on one like specific type of fasting method. So it's a little hard to like extrapolate what the outcomes mean for various studies. So one of the more popular ways to intermittent fast is a 16-hour fasting window followed by an 8-hour eating window. So typically the 16 hours takes part overnight, plus a little bit of extra on either end, and then 8 hours to eat during the day. There's also like 12-12 intermittent fasting, which is like 12 hours of fasting overnight and 12-hour feeding window during the day. There's time-restricted feeding and alternate day fasting too. Basically, like alternate day fasting can be anything from, you know, going like 24 hours without eating and then having a 24-hour feeding window and kind of alternating, or going 5 days of eating followed by like 48 hours of fasting. And then there is time-restricted feeding too, such as like Ramadan, where folks who celebrate and participate in Ramadan-related fasting for religious purposes fast overnight and then kind of break that fast. Fast during the day and then break that fast in the nighttime. So a lot of the research that we do actually have on fasting, especially for like athletes, is athletes who observe Ramadan. So there's definitely some flaws to this, just because fasting isn't like the only, I guess, player in Ramadan and some of the outcomes. You know, we've also got changes in sleep patterns, circadian rhythm, and some of the negative outcomes of these studies, or I guess the negative outcomes these studies show fasting can have on things like performance, is thought to also maybe have to do with like sleep being disrupted because of religious practices, in addition to fasting. So again, the research isn't perfect and we need more of it to really be able to come to conclusions here. But in terms of defining fasting, that's what I mean when I'm talking about fasting. There's a lot of different methods, and we'll kind of dive into some of the nuances of what I recommend and what I don't recommend based off of the research that we do have. So now let's get into pros and cons. So some of the pros to start there are that, like, you know, in terms of fasting, it's not really like, hey, you need to stay away from certain foods. It's not restrictive in terms of like cutting out a food group like some diets can be, but it does restrict the window in which you're allowed to eat. It does still give a set of rules around, you know, how to eat that do have a restrictive lens on them. So I'm putting this in the pros category because I know some people talk about how, you know, hey, this kind of helps me put myself into like a calorie deficit because it feels very doable to me and not as restrictive. Although I've talked to plenty of people too who find the opposite and would put it in the cons category where they're like, it definitely, you know, makes me feel too restricted. And, you know, I have some negative side effects because of that, but it is what it is. And in terms of the research on fasting, we definitely have some positive short-term outcomes on cholesterol levels, on insulin resistance, potential anti-aging benefits, and cognitive benefits. But most of this research has been found in more of a sedentary population in short-term studies. And part of that is because it's hard to kind of do like nutrition research that's of high quality longer term. It's hard to get people to do a thing for a long period of time, especially if the thing is restrictive, because there's less of a chance that they are going to adhere to it long term. But there are also some long term benefits of fasting metabolically. However, it has also been determined in this type of research that it's thought that the benefits come with the potential of being in a calorie deficit. And I use benefits under this lens of, you know, they're showing outcomes like weight loss, decrease in cholesterol, decrease in fasting glucose. That doesn't necessarily mean that's a benefit for everyone. Some people don't need that, right? But, you know, that's kind of some of the pros of fasting. And in terms of, you know, other pros that I've heard in practice, it's just some people like it. Like, it's easy. It's easier than eating for some people, especially for folks who struggle, like really struggle to consume anything like pre-workout. They can kind of use fasting as a tool to avoid working on toleration of food pre-workout. I personally in practice have worked with hundreds of runners, and I've never like not been able to help someone fuel before a workout. And I've worked with very complicated cases, people with very severe GI issues. And we've always been able to find a way, and kind of had positive outcomes because of that. But I can also understand that for some people, it is just ease of getting themselves to be able to exercise. Maybe you only have a window to exercise at 4, you know, in the morning, and otherwise you're not going to exercise, and it's really hard for you to eat before that. So that's just kind of what you're doing it as like more of a convenience factor. I used to do that. I totally get it. I used to be a 3:30 a.m. runner. But again, we're going to talk about how that's a double-edged sword because there's also some long-term potential cons to that. So now to kind of dive into the cons category. So in terms of performance, we really don't have much long-term evidence showing, you know, benefits for performance. We don't have long-term evidence in terms of like, you know, no benefits either. Like, there's just not much there. We also have some short-term evidence that shows we decrease performance when we incorporate fasting. So that's obviously not good if a lot of you are here to learn how to improve your performance. A lot of the research too on athletes specifically is, again, it's really hard to extrapolate conclusions because some of them, you know, some of the studies are on, you know, Ramadan focused fasting. Others are on 16-hour to 8-hour window fasting. Some are on alternate day fasting. Some are on 12, you know, hour fasting, 12-hour feeding, mixed population, anywhere from, you know, males, mostly males, to be honest, not much on female population, very small sample sizes. So again, the research that we do have, like we have a little bit on a lot of different things, but not like a lot on one specific type of thing. So I would love to see more studies on like, you know, 16 hours of fasting, 8 hours of feeding, you know, on female endurance athletes. Like I would love to see more of that to see, hey, like, is this something that is beneficial or does it matter or is it not beneficial? Because we've got some researchers saying they really think it wouldn't be a good idea for females to do that because of various physiological factors that differ in female hormones and metabolism. But we also don't really have the research, like an abundance of it to show it goes one way or the other either. So I'm putting that in the cons category because it's just kind of like, well, shrug, we don't really know, which is why, you know, it's hard to recommend it because it wouldn't be super evidence-based to do so. So in terms of cons that I see in practice, knowing that there's not a ton of evidence for me to go off of, because while I am an evidence-based provider, I also am not evidence limited and I can, you know, extrapolate things I see in practice. And that goes both ways. If people are like, hey, this works really good for me, you know, that's something that I'm using in my clinical experience. And if people are like, this doesn't work for me, or this keeps happening and it's negatively impacting my life, or we can see, you know, that it's negatively impacting your health on the own data that we gather, you know, then I'm going to go off of that too. So what I see really often in practice, and whenever I talk about fasting on the internet, I piss so many people off. I always joke with my team. I'm like, okay, we're going to talk about fasting on the internet. So prepare, like the trolls are going to come for us. And a lot of them are dudes who are ultra runners, to be honest. And I think people forget that my main population, if you look at my data for who listens to this podcast, for who listens, you know, to my Instagram post ramblings, I literally have the data because that's what social media and this platform that my podcast is on gathers for us, is mostly women ages, you know, 20 to 40. And a lot of you I know have had a history of an eating disorder. My master's is in eating disorders. I am a dietitian. I work in the non-diet, you know, like no restrictive approach space on the internet. I know that who I attract probably has some demons in this category, right? I did, right? People relate to me. That's why a lot of you are probably here. So I'm not always necessarily talking to, you know, the 40-year-old dude who has never had an issue with food. Okay. I am talking to typically the female who, you know, has a menstrual cycle or should have a menstrual cycle. Some of you I know are also entering perimenopause, who have some hormone stuff going on and grew up in the 90s and 2000s and just don't have a good relationship with food. Okay. We know too that at least half of endurance athletes do struggle with underfueling, whether it is intentional or unintentional, you know, kind of depends. But again, my lens that I am working through is that. So I am kind of constantly looking at research studies on various topics and interpreting them for specific people or my specific audience. You know, if I was talking to, you know, 50-year-old men who don't exercise at all, yeah, I might be saying some different stuff on my platforms, but I know a lot of you are not that, right? So what do I see in practice knowing that this is the population that I work with, okay? I tend to see that fasting is still a form of restriction in the, you know, physiological human space almost always leads to binging, especially when the restriction is intentional. Like if we are, you know, actively trying to restrict ourselves, it is almost always the biggest predictor of a binge or overdoing it later on. And a lot of the times with my population, this can become a disordered behavior. It can really negatively impact life, quality of life, and health, mental health too. And that's why we're trying to avoid that. So if, you know, we're kind of over here going, hey, fasting is going to be a form of restriction for you and make you binge, then no, it's not a good idea for you, right? I also see all the time that a lot of my athletes really, really struggle to eat enough already. And even if they are overeating at some point in their day because of a binge, or kind of this yo-yo mentality, it's because they were under eating before, right? So it's still the root cause is still lack of enough nutrition. And again, fasting is a form of restriction and it can exacerbate this problem. So why would we do it if we struggle with that, right? So that's something that I see often is it can almost perpetuate underfueling and therefore low energy availability symptoms that can turn into relative energy deficiency and sport syndrome, which affects every system in the body. And again, I work with males, females, everyone, you know, across the running community. I do work with mostly females. And there is like a there's like a lot in the communities talking about female hormones that says something along the lines of, and I'm totally guilty of this. I have said this and I'm trying to like switch my message and my verbiage, especially since having a baby, because I have a different perspective on it now. but there is a lot of messaging going, hey, women are more sensitive to stress. Like female hormones are more sensitive to stress than male hormones. And this message kind of implies that women can't handle a lot. And I totally, explicit word coming, fucking disagree with that. Especially since going through childbirth, women deal with a lot more in a lot of cases, you know, across the span of their life cycle, in terms of bodily changes, hormone changes, you know, there's a lot more transitions that we can potentially go through. Again, in a vacuum, this is not everyone, but compared to men, men tend to have puberty, testosterone that slowly declines as they age. And that's kind of like the gist of male hormone aging. Whereas women tend to go through puberty and then they start a menstrual cycle where their hormones are doing something different like every week out of the month on a monthly cycle. And if that's irregular, it can really fuck with the rest of their health, right? And then if they do choose or don't choose, but somehow get pregnant, their hormones are going to change again and basically skyrocket off the charts to create a new human. Then they have to birth said human and then their hormones fall off a cliff. And if they breastfeed, that can kind of suppress their hormones for a while until they stop breastfeeding. And then their hormones are supposed to go back to cycling. And then they go through perimenopause, which is basically like a circus for hormones, where hormones are all over the place doing whatever the heck they want before they eventually bottom out. Okay. So like if I were to put this on a chart, and plenty of websites and infographics have, it basically looks like a toddler, you give a toddler a pen and it just like scribbled all over the chart. It's chaos, right? So I don't want to say that women are more sensitive to stress, but I do want to say women's hormones have a lot more going on. There's a lot more complexity that they have to go through each day to do what we can offer in life than men. So if we are putting an extra stressor on that complex process, it can crumble and just make us not thrive. And women have been suppressed for decades and centuries. So like we deserve to thrive. So, and take up space and eat food and not be restricted. So again, fasting for some women, not all, but for some women in practice that I have observed through my clinical experience do not respond well to fasting, especially when they are asking a lot of their bodies to not just have good hormone health, but also perform physically at a really high level as a runner, as an endurance athlete, you know, whatever sport you choose. So in terms of that really long-winded answer, you know, I do see that fasting can basically mess up hormones in women because women's hormones are more complex than men's because we have to basically do more complex stuff biologically. That's just the hand that we were dealt. So, you know, it can exacerbate hormone-related problems and symptoms. So if you tend to have really bad PMS, it can make that worse. If you're going through perimenopause and you're having all kinds of symptoms, hot flashes, you know, mood disorders, brain fog, weight gain, it can make that worse, is my experience working with women in that category. If you're struggling to like get your period because you think maybe you're under fueling or are taking on too much stress and it's making your hormones super suppressed because your body's not physically able to make them, guess what's not going to help? Restricting your caloric intake or restricting how much food you eat in a day and when. Not super helpful. So if you're trying to get your period back, fasting or any fasted workouts are an absolute no-no. And I also do see in females that I work with, it does tend to be correlated at least with increased cortisol levels. And I will eventually also see adrenals that become dysfunctional and cortisol actually can become too low, which can really exacerbate a lot of other symptoms as well. Plan to do a whole episode on cortisol soon because I keep getting asked about it. So more coming on that. But that's another thing that I see in clinical practice is that it can just kind of throw a wrench in the female hormone process. And that's not because we're weaker or just more sensitive little daisies. It's because we have to do more physiologically and it just makes it a little bit harder for us to do that optimally and thrive. In practice as well, I do also see it can trigger like disordered eating behaviors. Again, there's not really like a huge great predictor of what can trigger eating disorders or disordered eating behaviors, but typically any type of restrictive anything is a good predictor, like tracking your food or fasting or going on a diet. Anything that can kind of, you know, trigger that, I don't like signing people up for because I know I tend to work with that population anyway. And disordered eating and eating disorders have super high mortality rates. And that's just not something I want to mess with. Another thing is that it can really mess with your hunger and fullness hormones. I find that endurance athletes really struggle with this, especially if you're kind of putting your body through so much that your hunger hormones get blunted. Again, I find fasted workouts can make that a lot worse. I found when people fuel before, during, and after their workouts really well, the workout isn't as much of an insult to the body and they recover a lot better and have a better, more even appetite throughout the rest of the day, which is very important for many reasons. Now, before we jump into a newer 2024 systematic review on intermittent fasting and performance, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Thank you so much to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode of the Hollyfield Nutrition Podcast. Regardless if you have a clinical mental health issue like depression or anxiety, or if you're just a human who lives in this world who is going through a hard time, therapy can give you tools to approach your life in a different way. And that's why I am so excited to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp's mission is to make therapy more affordable, more accessible. And this is an important mission because finding a therapist can be really, really hard, especially when you're limited to the options in your area. BetterHelp is a platform that makes finding a therapist easier because it's online, it's remote, and by filling out just a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to a professional therapist in a little as a few days. When I used BetterHelp, it was a few hours. So it is truly a very quick and easy process compared to what I've had clients experience and what I've experienced myself in traditionally trying to find a therapist through the healthcare system. It is really easy to sign up and get matched with a therapist. There is a link in my description, which is BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/HollyFueled, which is HollyFueled. And that link is in the description. Clicking that link helps support this podcast, and it also gets you 10% off your first month of BetterHelp so you can connect with a therapist and see if it helps you out. Because finding a therapist can be a little bit like dating, if you don't really fit with the first therapist they match you to, which is super common in healthcare and therapy, you can easily switch to a new therapist at no additional cost without stressing about insurance, who's in your network, or anything like that. So if you are struggling, book the appointment, get started, consider online therapy with BetterHelp. visit the link in the description. And again, if this is something that you think is going to help you or you're nervous about it, taking the plunge is the most important first step. And then BetterHelp is going to let you sort out the rest. Now let's get back to the episode. So in 2024, there was a, which is this year, as I'm recording this, in January, there was a systematic review from the Nutrients Journal released on basically just like an update summary of fasting and how it can affect performance and sports and exercise. Basically, the study was interesting in design. It looked at a couple different studies, narrowed it down quite a bit. And out of 14 studies that it extrapolated its data and conclusions from, basically, I kind of just went down and counted and looked into each study. But out of 14, about 10 of those studies basically showed there was no effect on performance, either aerobically or anaerobically. So if you're here, you're probably more of an aerobic athlete because you're probably more of like a half and full marathoner versus like a 50-yard dasher. but there was not much effect. So not positive, like not better than not fasting, and also not worse, right? So nothing special is what 10 studies found out of 14. And this included two other reviews, one with 46 other studies and one with 23 other studies. So I would say from that, the body of research shows no improvement, no better performance benefits than not, okay? And then out of those 14 studies, one, which really they counted twice, it showed that it could improve like sprinting. And this was from an overnight fasting study with 20 people. So not so much like a time-restricted feeding like Ramadan or anything super specific. And then another one study that they counted twice showed that it decreased performance and negatively impacted performance for high intensity interval training workouts. And that study also had 20 people. So, I mean, I kind of say those cancel each other out because it's one pro and one con. They both have 20 people. They're both not that great of studies, to be honest, looking into them. And then 10, which included, you know, an additional, math in my head, an additional 69 studies showed there was no effect. So basically, not much effect. And again, the data here is flawed because there's small sample sizes. It's mostly men. They're not all the same type of fasting. There's other factors that are not controlled for, and they are by no means perfect. Okay. But we show there's no benefit. There's also not a ton of like negative outcome from a performance standpoint from these short-term studies. Okay. That's what this systematic review showed. The systematic review also basically discusses some studies that show a decrease in fat mass and potential improvements in like fasting glucose and blood pressure. But it basically extrapolates a conclusion from this that none of these studies actually show at all. But it basically says, hey, maybe if there's a decrease in body weight, maybe this would improve performance outcomes. And like maybe if, you know, there is a decrease in some blood lipids, maybe this would improve injury prevention, ? But these studies really don't show that. They just basically show, hey, this is what we found specifically, but we can't really, you know, basically say this will have this huge long-term benefit because really none of the studies show that. It did also discuss that as a form of calorie restriction, that is probably why a decrease in fat mass was found. And it wasn't probably because of like something special with fasting, but rather that fasting can also have calorie restriction, which was observed in those studies, and that adherence to this type of calorie restriction might be better because you're not restricting a food group, but that was kind of hairy as well. So essentially, nothing really special about this new review. It basically shows, in terms of the body research, no benefit, but not like a ton of direct non-benefit on performance either. So in terms of the risks, I kind of went over those already. And that's where, as a practitioner, and for me, helping people with this and putting education on a large platform out there, you know, I kind of weigh the, you know, the risks. And for me, you know, I tend to be a cautious individual. I want people to be healthy. I know that some of these risks, like low energy availability, REDS, hormone issues, bad relationship with food, disordered eating tendencies, can really throw people for a loop and negatively impact health long term. And that's not something I'm willing to assist people in signing up for. I would rather be cautious and say, you know, if we're going to just like pick a method to improve your performance and your health, why not eat food? You know, like, why not restrict? Let's try that instead. That seems a little bit like the path of least resistance for a lot of people. Even if it's just having a couple sips of juice before you go out for a run in the morning, like, or some sugar in your coffee, like, you know, that seems like a little bit, if there's going to be more benefit or at least less risk to that, like, let's do that instead of putting, you know, doing weird stuff like with your nutrition, like just restricting when we don't need to. So that's definitely one of my takeaways. I know for the audience that I have, it tends to maybe be more risky than beneficial. And most of the clients I work with have tried fasting before and it's not gotten them to a good place. So, you know, that's, again, that's my bias. That is who I see in practice. And that is why I talk about what I talk about on my platforms, in conjunction with being evidence-based. Like, there's just no effect on performance. So it's not necessarily something I really want to recommend to everyone, knowing that the people that I'm talking to have some factors that may contradict, you know, this being good for them. If you're like, I love, like, you know, the idea of fasting, and I do maybe want to get some of those other benefits, anti-aging, you know, cholesterol, et cetera. You know, I kind of say, one, again, remember that research is not on an active population. It's mostly on a sedentary population. So you can try it and see if it helps you, like do an N equals one experiment and see if it helps you. Again, it doesn't mean it'll help your best friend. So don't go preaching it to everyone, but you could always do an experiment on yourself and see if it helps you, looking at your lab work and whatnot. But I tend to recommend, hey, if you're gonna do that, fast overnight, like do a 12-hour fast between dinner and breakfast and then have a 12-hour eating window during the day. You don't need to be super strict with it, but I do think a longer period of fasting overnight can be helpful for the digestive system. It can help you sleep better, but if it's going to prevent you from getting enough calories to support your training and your basic bodily functions without going into low energy availability, it's not for you. For most of the runners I talk to, I would also recommend, hey, if you're gonna do that, don't fast before your workout. Like, have your fasting window be separate from your workout so that you can eat something before you go work out. This is also how I help runners I've worked with in the past who do observe Ramadan. You know, we will have really specific interventions so that basically the potential risks of fasting don't haunt them after Ramadan has come to an end. All of the athletes I have worked with who observe Ramadan have been female and have had really terrible, you know, health outcomes from observing it year after year after year. It's made them want to work with me. We've worked together, come up with specific strategies, and basically it's improved, you know, not having Ramadan have any long-term negative effects linger on them. So for example, they don't miss their period for several months, or they don't get a stress fracture. So that's also, again, anecdotally something that I observe in practice. So if you can avoid a fasted workout, that can be helpful and basically help you negate as much risk with fasting, as an athlete. I also, you know, basically just highly recommend fueling enough throughout the day. And if you're feeling like, oh, like it's really hard for me to get enough food in this strict eating window that I've given myself, then don't do it. Like, it's not going to benefit you. It's just like when I talk about people who want to use caffeine as an ergogenic aid to boost their performance, but they don't tolerate caffeine well. I'm like, well, you know, caffeine is an ergogenic aid in terms of the research, but like, if you hate it, you don't have to use it. You know, if it makes you poop your pants, you don't have to use it. Or same thing with carbon plated shoes. Yeah, there's some promising research on carbon plated shoes, but if you hate them or every time you wear them, you get a foot injury, they're not beneficial to you, right? So again, it's not for everyone. And when I am talking about it, this is kind of what I mean by that. It's also, you know, good to bring up, there's a lot of really talented elite athletes who fast, who do fasted training, who are fat adapted, who preach this from the rooftops, even though they have no credentials to do so. And again, just because it works for them doesn't mean it'll work for the population in their audience. And I can think of a couple specific female endurance athletes who are elite athletes, a couple in particular who talked about it a lot, like on their YouTube channels. And then they basically, you know, had one good race and then 2 years of injuries and were not able to compete at the Olympic trials when they should have been really promising because they were doing weird stuff with their nutrition. And really, they just needed to fuel properly. So again, we could probably all be the best version of ourselves if we are well fueled. And that's going to look a little bit different person to person. But in my experience working with endurance athletes, it tends to be eating enough before, during, and after your workouts, eating enough throughout the day, and not having a complicated relationship with food and healing from the inside out with that. Having plenty of nutrient availability and fasting really isn't the way to do that for a lot of people. So my key takeaways, you know, I'm updating this episode 4 years later. I feel a little bit less like strongly in terms of, you know, saying it's bad for everyone. I do think there's some populations that might have some benefit to it, but I know for my population, it's still not the best. It's still not a good idea. We still just want to eat enough food. We don't need to do weird stuff with our nutrition. If fasting's something that you must practice because of religious reasons, there are ways to do it to decrease the risk. And that's something that I have helped plenty of athletes with. But I know 100% of those athletes have basically said, you know, if I didn't have to fast, I'd probably get a little bit more ahead during my year, performance-wise, because I wouldn't have like this big hole that I have to deal with, essentially. So again, you know, it's definitely something that you can do and can be done to negate risk. But for most people, it's not the best. And in terms of the research we have, it's no better than fueling and does come with some more risk. So that's it for this episode. I hope this answers some of the questions you have all been asking me about intermittent fasting. If you enjoyed this episode, please, 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 I would really appreciate a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform. If you think I'm worthy of that, it's really helpful. It helps this episode and the podcast reach more people. So I can keep getting this free content, free for you, not free for me to make, a lot of work for me to make, out to more people and have it be accessible for you guys. Cause I do love the podcast. It's been super fun, even still now, 4 years later, when I'm talking about the same subject. So, but of course updating the research. So I hope this was helpful. And until next time, happy fueling and happy running.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.